Welcome to Multimedia Security in 2018. Last time we talked about photo response non-uniformity to identify a device. And I would like to add a couple of details. First of all, I think I did not talk about a noise model for this PRNU application, right? So that is something that is typically done very early on in the discussion, but I sort of came from an application perspective. So let's add it now. Let's call it image formation model. And that essentially contains the noise. So the assumption is that an observed pixel Y is consists of like the ideal signal in terms of photons hitting the sensor, X plus some source or some shot noise, eta. This is multiplied, I'd write something to this, by a multiplicative term F. That's going to be our photoresponse non-uniformity. And then we have two more sources of noise. One is the dark current, and one is, I think it was the readout noise, epsilon. So let me explain all these symbols. So why is the observed pixel intensity? X is the ideal signal. If we would have a perfect measurement device, eta denotes shot noise, F is the PRNU. C is dark current, and this is electronic noise. So the idea is that eta, C, and epsilon, they have different realizations from image to image. This means if you hold the camera or if you statically mount the camera somewhere and you twice press the trigger, take two pictures, you will have different realizations of eta, C, and epsilon. Yeah, and that's actually the reason why the extraction of the fingerprint is proposed to be done by averaging a large number of pictures. Yeah, because then eta, c, and epsilon average out. And what we end up having is something like a product of f times x. And then we perform the high pass filtering in order to get as much of f as possible. And if we have different image content, then x also averages out. And we ideally just end up with the PRNU signal f. Yeah, that's the ideal. I mean, it never works like this. Yeah, but that's the whole idea. Yeah. So let's put this down. So eta, c, and epsilon vary from. Actually, no, that's not. So let's say eta and epsilon vary from image to image. And x and c vary with image content. And f is fixed. Since maybe you remember it from before Christmas, it's a property of the mask, like the illuminated area on the sensor. Depending on how it comes out of the production line, the area is a little bit larger or a little bit smaller. But this intuitively also makes clear this area does not change with changing environmental conditions. So f is fixed since it is determined during manufacturing of the sensor. So it's the photosensitive area. Okay. So this means if we average multiple images with little and varying content, little yet varying content, f and high pass, high pass filtering comes before, f is computed, or f is obtained. Okay, so that is the, like, from a image formation side, that is the justification why the fingerprint extraction works, yeah? And why the fingerprint improves when more images or sufficiently many images are averaged. Hmm? Okay. There are, like, when it comes to practical implementations, there are a number of cases that are not very helpful. Yeah. very dark images, for example. In very dark images, the dark current dominates, and we don't get any useful signal out of this. If we have very bright, saturated areas, then also this noise model does not hold. So we can effectively only use pixel intensities that are somewhere in the middle range. Yeah. So let's say between 50 and 245 or so. Yeah, 250, something like this. That should be a safe range. Yeah. So as a side note, exclude very dark and very bright pixels. The noise model only holds for middle intensities. For example, I mean, it's a little bit arbitrary, but let's say between 50 and 200. Shall I write 250? Okay, 250, something like this. You see, the exact numbers are a little bit arbitrary, but to give you an impression. Okay. Good. So this fingerprint, it's our strongest method to uniquely identify a device. This is certainly true. There are, however, a number of limitations. And we should quickly mention them as well. Limitations. So, did we already talk about this? Or just if you apply common sense, what might be bad for the PRNU signal?
I guess compression or filtering?
Compression is bad, yeah. So lossy compression, I mean, and we think of JPEG, lossy compression may be harmful. To PRNU, yeah, because it acts as a low pass filter. That's right. There's also a subtle problem that is oftentimes overlooked. And I think I'm just gonna tell you that is zoom is bad. All types of zoom are bad. Zooming desynchronizes PRNU, and that is for two reasons. So there are two types of zoom. There's an optical zoom, no? Essentially by moving the lenses, and there's digital zoom. Okay, I think it totally makes sense that digital zoom is bad for PRLU because we are rescaling the image, so we are not aligned with our pixels anymore. Okay, that was easy. But also the optical zoom is bad. And the reason for that is a little bit more subtle, because essentially you're changing the magnification in the lenses. The light falls onto the same sensor cells. So in the first place, you would assume there's no problem with optical zoom, right? It's the same sensor cells. But the actual problem is that optical magnification of the signal leads to distortion. Maybe you've read about this or so at some point. There's barrel distortion and pincushion distortion, depending on whether it goes in or out. Let me show you a picture really quickly. And and the camera vendors know that, yeah, and it disturbs the visual impression, yeah, because if you, for example, if you take a picture of a building with a lot of straight lines, suddenly these aren't straight lines anymore. So internally in the camera, they compensate for this distortion and desynchronize your fingerprint. So let me, or are all of you familiar with distortion? Then I don't need to show this. Optical distortion. Distortion. Do we have? It's coming. Distortion optics. No, it's not. That was too optimistic. Right, there we go. Yep. So if you take a picture of straight horizontal and vertical lines, then pincushion, I was misspelling pincushion anyway. So pincushion distortion bends the lines towards the center, barrel distortion bends it towards the outside. Camera vendors know that, compensate for it. So this means they locally rescale the image or radially rescale the image, depending on what model they assume, and that desynchronizes the fingerprint. Bad luck. And then and once we know that, we can think of other types that are really bad for the fingerprint. Let me write this down, and then we're getting there. So electronic zoom, or digital zoom, sorry, digital zoom. It's just it's a rescaling operation. So that is, I hope, is relatively intuitive that it desynchronizes. Optical zoom, introduces pincushion or barrel distortion. that disturbs the visual appearance of the image. Therefore, vendors correct for this by interpolation and thereby desynchronize the fingerprint. Yeah, that's a side effect, no? But if we think about this last effect a little bit more and think of modern cameras, then maybe we can get ideas or develop ideas of other problems that also destroy the fingerprint. Just.
I mean, every modern handy camera has some fancy filtering, so like vintage filter.
Oh yeah, vintage filter. Right. If you have, specific filters may be bad. That's true.
Not only that, but I think that smartphone producers also do something that your pictures look better than others, so there's a superimposing of color. So
yeah.
The display, the images look
right.
More fancier than the
regular. Right. That's true. Let's subsume this under filtering.
What about mobile phones that come with two cameras, where they fuse the image from multiple cameras?
That's a very aggressive operation, yeah. Like all types of computational imaging, also if you have this optical stabilization of pictures, or if you think of, is it the iPhone or Google's Pixel or so, that internally acquires a video and then looks at the video frames and tries to put this together to a nice picture. So these are operations that are really bad for the PRNU. Yeah. So all kinds of computational photography for example digital image stabilization how is this called, this is it a light field camera? No, not really. It allows to refocus the image, right?
Yeah, but sometimes they also have different cameras with different lens opening angles, so they can fuse the image with different brightness.
Mm-hmm.
So one camera is specialized for dark areas.
Yeah. Okay, let's. I did not prepare for this, but we can. I mean, there are lots of fancy videos on YouTube. So let's say all that falls in this category of I'm not presenting actual sensor measurements, of course, breaks our assumptions on the sensor traces. No? Okay. Okay. But other than that, it's a really, it's an exciting method, of course. Good. Yeah, sorry. So in the field of digital image forensics, that is probably the most well-known single method, no? Looking for PRNU patterns. Yeah, but and it's certainly one of the strongest. But if we look at this list of limitations, I think it's clear that it's not gonna stand like forever, no? Because like modern smartphones already sort of invalidated currently. and what I would like to talk about now are so-called residual-based methods, which are similar in spirit. Patrick already talked about it when he was here instead of me. or talked about his specific project and residual methods. So these residual methods have the potential to, or maybe will show a way out of this problem, yeah, that the camera originals themselves are, strictly speaking, already sort of manipulations, no? Because they are computed from multiple images. So what should we tell about their authenticity? okay, but first things first. Residual based manipulation detection. I mean, we already know the foundations of this residual-based manipulation detection, and that is when we think of the steganography chapter, there Jessica Friedrich proposed these very high-dimensional feature sets to determine whether a steganographic signal has been embedded into a picture or not. And so conversely, it means this very high dimensional feature set should determine whether the statistical distribution in an image, of the residuals in an image, is natural or not. If it's unnatural, we say, okay, there's a steganographic signal in there. And then the idea by Annalisa Vadoliva was to apply these steg analysis methods to image forensics, modify them a little bit, adapt them a little bit, but any deviation from a natural image, I mean, finding such deviations should, in principle, also be useful for detecting image manipulations. That was the idea. Yeah. So, the idea and that was by, I think her passport name is Luisa Verdoliva. She calls herself Annalisa. So by Luisa Verdoliva is that if stack analytic features can distinguish natural images from Stego images, we should also be able, or we, yeah, we should also be able to use these features to distinguish natural images from manipulations. I think it's a very, it's a very logical idea. And I mean, of course, some adaptations make sense and so on, but other than that, it's a very natural idea. And the reward was that Annalisa won the IEEE Information Forensics and Security Challenge I think 2013 the challenge was running, 2014 the winners were announced, so somewhere around then, yeah, there was a big competition. Can you detect these manipulations, or can you detect, can you find the manipulations in this data set and tell me where they have been manipulated? And then she won by a large margin by essentially capitalizing on that idea. So it was, at that time, it was really a new idea, and it also has some sustaining impact. So it's still an idea that people are actually actively pursuing. Okay, and that's what we're gonna talk about. So first of all, what is a residual? A residual, or let me start with the processing pipeline, and that explains what a residual is. So the rough statistical model. And we can fill in the details later. So we high pass filter the image. That's again to take out the image content. High pass filter the image. And let's say we use as a filter 1 -3, 3 -1. You may say that is awfully specific. Yes, it is. But anyways, let's work with this. Yeah, it's a high pass filter. That's hopefully clear. Yeah, so we have a filter that looks like this. Yeah. Well. Okay. And then. We crop and quantize the high frequency content. To values -2, -1, 0, 1, 2, for example. Again, you can say, oh, that's awfully specific, but it's not relevant to the overall approach. So we have a very limited alphabet. So what means cropping? It means if the result of this filter is, let's say, larger than -2, smaller than -2 or larger than +2, then we just set it to -2 or +2. Yeah. Okay. What means quantizing? It means that we don't we are not necessarily forced to focus on the filter outputs in the range of -2 until +2. We could also say we multiply everything by 2. So these residuals actually stand for or represent intensities of -4, -2, 0, 2, +4. Yeah, something like this. No, but what we end up having for each pixel is a number like 1 out of 5 symbols, for example. No, or we could also do 7 or so. Yeah? Doesn't matter. Okay, good. And then what we look at. So these are the residuals. So these are the residuals. And now all that is missing is that to build a statistical model of these residuals. Yeah. And the way Annalisa proposes to do that is to look at co-occurrences, so neighborhoods of these residuals, and just count. So just set up a histogram, which residual occurs how often in a local neighborhood with other residuals. Yeah? And then we say, okay, so these are the histograms of a natural image from that camera, for example. And then we compute a distance from the histograms of an image under question from that camera. Or we can, within the image, say, okay, I'm computing these histograms for the left half of the image and are comparing it to the right half of the image. So within the image, I can assess the consistency of the model. So we have all kinds of options and are purely statistical. So we don't have a model assumption as we used it for the PRNU to rely on. But instead, if we think about what is contained in these residuals, yeah, what the hell is contained in residuals of that type? What information do we cover here? edges. We certainly have edge remainings in there, but these are undesired because that's image content. No? So, yeah. And we sort of reduce them by cropping, high and low values. So let's think about regions other than edge regions.
Well, it's the noise of the areas where no edges.
Mm-hmm. What noise?
Well, all the types of noise.
Like everything. Yeah. It's like all these variables that we just wrote down, plus JPEG stuff, if applicable. No, it's a weird mixture of everything. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's yeah.
Only thing on the high frequencies, not noises. Like, I mean, like
high frequency noise. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Could be of lower frequency.
Yes. That's right. That's right. But if we, I mean, I didn't write this down explicitly yet. But if we say we look at neighborhoods of 4 pixels or so, then we, with good probability, we are hitting a JPEG block boundary or something, and there we get an artificial JPEG edge in our residuals as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Right. So these residuals, they don't make many assumptions. So it's really like a black box. No? I have a histogram of a neighborhood of residuals, and I say, I hope that this histogram is characteristic for my device, or at least for this, or even only for this specific picture. Yeah. Because maybe then I change the camera settings afterwards, and then I have different statistics. Yeah. But as long as I'm searching within the same picture, for example, for inconsistencies, it should be okay. Right. So these are the assumptions that are behind these residuals. Now, let me write down the co-occurrences and the histogram idea before talking too much about applications of this. Are there questions? Then just, sorry? So the statistical model looks like this. Group rows, and then afterwards columns, if you transpose the image, columns of, again, I'm just pulling a number, 4 neighboring residuals to a word. How many different words can we form? It's a mean question. So we take 4, we compute those residuals. We can have values between -2 and +2, integer values between -2 and +2. And we take 4 of these neighboring residuals and say, this is one word that we consider. How many different words do exist in our universe? Yes, so 5 to the power of 4. Okay, we can make a footnote or so. Our universe has 5 to the power of 4, 625 words. And then we can say for a region in the image, compute a histogram of the occurring words. So this would mean our histogram has 625 entries, but similar to work that Jessica Friedrich's group did on stack analysis, we can say, okay, let's put symmetric words into one bin. Let's put the symmetries. And symmetries and rotational like symmetries or identities. Yeah. So if it's a cyclic shift, if one word is a cyclic shift of another word, let's also put it in the same bin. Okay. So that means for a region of the image, compute a histogram of the occurring words. To keep the model more compact, because these high dimensional spaces are always a pain, put symmetries and cyclic shifts of words into the same bin. So this leads to about, I forgot the exact number, but something around 360 or so bins. So let's say, Annalisa herself wrote something a little bit more than 300 bins. Okay. I thought it was 360. But yeah, it doesn't matter. No. Okay, and then in order to assess the consistency, so the consistency check is to compute a second histogram. And then to compute the Mahalanobis distance. So compute a second histogram, compute the Mahalanobis distance, the first So Mahalanobis distance is distance of h prime equals h prime minus some mean of the model times the inverse of the covariance matrix of the model times h prime minus the mean of the model. So this, where mu equals 1 over n, and then the sum over a number of model histograms. So here we had only one, but actually we can take like half of the image, subdivided in blocks, add them all together. And the covariance, well, it's just the standard covariance, 1 over n times the sum of n equals 1 to n h n minus mu transpose. The transpose comes later, sorry. H n minus mu now transpose. Okay. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Yeah, sorry, I was a little bit imprecise. So I can average multiple histograms for the model. That forms like the mean of all model histograms. If I only have one histogram, then that's still like the mean equals to the histogram entries. But if I have multiple histograms, I also have a covariance between these multiple histograms. So in that sense, it's a little bit stupid to only take one histogram for a model. No? So I can compute a covariance between multiple model histograms and then evaluate the distance of a test histogram to that model, which essentially means compute the distance from the mean, or the squared distance from the mean, and weight it by the covariance. So if I have a feature dimension that varies a lot already in my training data, so in the model that I built, then this will have a large covariance. Since I'm dividing by the covariance, this feature dimension will have a lower weight. Yeah, you can think of it like this. Yeah, so the covariance matrix is weighting the distance to the mean, the relevance of this particular distance to the mean, something like this. Yeah, you can think of it like this. Good. Yeah, we really should change this to a plural to have it more correct. So for some model regions of the image, compute per region a histogram of the occurring words to keep the model more compact, put symmetries and cycling shifts of word into the same bin. Yeah. And then compute instead of second, we can say query histogram. Yeah, so this is the area that we would like to assess whether the statistical model is similar to the other regions. So this was really an effective choice. And let me show you some pictures associated with that. Or actually I can I put something in Studon, two papers on this. So let's just look at some pictures. So, this is the first paper that I put on Studon, and I think that was the first that Annalisa wrote on that approach. It's more or less a report, like what did we do in that forensics challenge. So let's see whether you can read this. So here, recently following an approach used in stack analysis, she's citing Jessica's paper here, we've devised a powerful descriptor-based forgery detection technique to tackle phase one of the first IEEE IFS-TC challenge. A high-pass filtering is first carried out. Okay, then she's writing essentially what I wrote here. and let's just look at some of the results. They are not so super pretty, but that's but still they were very effective. Can you see this? So here in so what comes out is a map that shows or that color codes the Mahalanobis distance at each pixel or region or so. I think it's a little bit overkill to do it per pixel, but okay. No? This is a comparison to related work. This looks more meaningful. Okay, so probably this is the Mahalanobis distance that comes out. Let's have a look at the legend. PRNU correlation index. Ah, yeah, okay. Just showing that PRNU breaks in this case. Okay, so here's the output of the Mahalanobis distance, and it essentially leads to a marking of this type. So in green are the true pixels of the manipulation, and in red, the one that were wrongly marked. But of course, if we have such a detailed, I mean, we can only be precise up to the region on which we compute the histogram. So therefore, if we have such a very detailed structure, there will always be some boundary pixels that are mislabeled. Yeah. So in this case, okay, the PRNU does a fairly good job, but overall, I think it's really the case that this residual-based approach is something that has a much greater future. For the limitations that that we stated on the PRNU, yeah, and the fact that PRNU always needs training data, yeah. So I need to know a number of reference images in order to extract the reference fingerprint. And here I don't need training data. I can apply that model within the same image, essentially, like use the left half for training and test it on the right half, things like this. Yeah.
But in this case, I think the testing was done with all approach, maybe? Because isolation would have to know in which half the manipulation.
Yes.
Probably the manipulation averages out then for our model histogram. So we still get this, these values, right?
Yes. So here we come to that's actually an excellent remark, because that's also, I think, the biggest problem with this approach is to determine what outliers are outliers, because I have no reference quantity to the distances that I'm expecting, and what outliers are due to manipulations. And that is, so here we can say, okay, we have something very red, no? So we set our threshold such that the red portion is segmented, and we assume it's a manipulation, yeah? But what if we just had an area here that is statistically significant, no? In a way, no? Maybe it's a saturated area, no? Saturated pixels should be very unusual compared to other pixels, no? Then we come also to your remark, no? Like, where should I separate? Should I take the left half of the image for training, the right half for testing? I see the distances are on average 5. And then I swap sides and I see, okay, the distances here are on average 8. Is that, and then I decide, like, okay, I take the whole image. As you say, I take the whole image and then I look for outliers in this joint model of everything. And so I'm lacking a little bit the reference here. So that is actually an ongoing challenge. That's an ongoing challenge that has to be addressed. I think, nevertheless, it's a very promising approach. It's useful even if you don't have a strategy to look for thresholds and so on. You can always use it for a manual analysis of things. But there is certainly also a texture dependence in. So that is my way, at least, to think about these things. And we are just currently essentially investigating that for the case of video data, because you can use essentially the same approach on videos also. But the question really is that bird here, is it really highlighted because it's a bird? Because it's a manipulation, or is it highlighted because it's the only white thingy there in the picture? No? And as long as there's no second white bird there that is not highlighted, you cannot really tell. No? So maybe you picked up some unusual texture, or maybe there's really something about that. Yeah. I think here is a nice example where you can say, okay, I look at the texture in this image and I really, like, there's nothing salient that comes to my eye. Now, when I look at this, suddenly here's a red region. I see there's no specific texture there. Why should it be red? Yeah. So that would be something where, if performing a manual analysis, you could say, okay, I'm super confident that there must be something going on in that image here, no? Because I can exclude specific textures as a reason for the statistical model to deviate. Similarly here in that desert picture, can probably not recognize this. It's just a desert, no? So why should there be like a rectangular area that suddenly gives a lot of signal, no? Or here also with some vegetation, No? But here again, it's a little bit difficult. No? There's a clock on the wall. No? It looks similar like the background. So you can say, okay, I don't see an immediate reason why this clock should particularly be highlighted, but it's a very like individual specific object. Yeah. So I think generally when it comes to insertion of objects into a scene, one has to be a little bit more careful with this approach, as opposed to if it comes to occlusion of some object with background elements. Yeah. For occlusion, we can be super confident, like, yeah, this has to be a manipulation and it works really well. For insertion, yeah. We're working on it. Okay. Good. Let's write a couple of things down, particularly also these caveats. So a little bit of storytelling. Okay, Annalisa's success at the challenge immediately popularized steganographic features for image forensics. So in my opinion, and also talking to other people, like, for example, I specifically talked also to Matthias Kirchner, who is a professor at Binghamton. So I think we all agree that this is this type of approach, it really has a future. It looks as if such statistical models can much better deal with pictures from cameras, or from very smart cameras, that apply a lot of internal processing. The reason for this is that explicit model assumptions are avoided. We can talk about it in a second. What are explicit model assumptions? Like, assuming we use a JPEG compressor of this and this type, assuming we have a camera that introduces chromatic, a lens that introduces chromatic aberration. Let's assume we have, we have the automated white balancing after creating a quantized image. Let's assume we have we have a gamma correction curve of a specific type or so. We're not making, like, we're not dealing with this. Yeah, we're just looking at histograms of stuff. Yeah, and we're not making any explicit model assumption. Is that explicit model assumptions are avoided? And only noise residuals within an image are compared, statistically compared. So in other words, the assumption that we make is that all processing that has been applied to an image has been sort of everywhere applied. Yeah. Thus, an assumption is that all parts of the image have undergone the same processing, same type of processing. But without specifying which. Okay. Okay, that was all the appraisal. Now, let's bring a little bit of criticism or limitations. Open challenges, open issues. Current limitations. So I think the number one problem is threshold shall be chosen. For the Mahalanobis distance to mark a manipulation. And the second one is how to separate influences from texture. And without adding too much detail, but a slight reference to the second paper that I've uploaded. So let me put it as Outlook or so. Residuals have also been used within deep networks . This allows in particular . So what does it allow? I'm not sure whether you're familiar with that concept, but if you are, it's great. What might be, so let's say we have some smart guy who translates us this processing that we saw earlier into a deep network, or at least a significant part of it, maybe not everything, but a significant part of it. What could be the advantage of that? Like a one-to-one translation, it's just a deep network then. Let's think about it for a minute. That might be an advantage.
Well, I was thinking maybe if we have a deep network, we can do more training, and then by training can figure out just these two problems. What is a good Mahalanobis threshold?
Mm-hmm.
And also maybe filter out the influence from the texture, because we know, okay, maybe this is texture and this not, so maybe this will make it easier for us to do the question.
Yeah, it would certainly, yeah, I think all this is true. What would we need for that? We would have to have some supervised scenario or something like this, probably. We would have to switch to supervised in order to solve this, probably, not sure. But we could certainly think of some, maybe a second, like we copy the network, like create two copies and make one a texture classifier and the other one a residual sort of classifier, and then like lead them together to one final stream, something like this, to address the texture. Could think of something like this, for example. No? Yeah? or just try to do it within one thing. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's also a valid idea. I was thinking like even a very much shorter step. So if we say we have a significant portion of that pipeline translated into a deep network, the fact that we can retrain the network allows to relax all these rather heuristic choices that we made. Yeah. So why should we quantize to, why should we use an alphabet of 5 symbols? Yeah. Why should we use word lengths of 4 or so? Yeah. So all this, why should we use this 1 -3, 3 -1 filter? Yeah. This is all a little bit arbitrary. No. And if we have a network formulation for at least one of these components, and we can say, oh, we retrain it and we allow, for example, the filter to adapt during the training. So then it maybe improves a little bit over our somewhat arbitrary choice that we made earlier. Yeah. So I think that is a perspective. So this allows in particular to adapt our somewhat arbitrary design choices. So let's say the 1 -3, 3 -1 filter to the data via, it's not called retraining, it's called, let's say retraining. And of course, it also allows them to address 1 or 2 in a data-driven manner. Okay, So the paper that I've put in Studon, it's just addressing this first point, and I'm not expecting you to go through all of the details there, but I think the basic idea is really nice, and in a way I would say it's also a typical application probably for neural networks in a way, no? So to get some filters as initialization and then to say, okay, let's retrain it and maybe the filters improve then. Yeah.
And then one other question. So we say as an assumption that all parts of the image have undergone the same type of processing. So what effect does that have if the image is like different parts of the image have been processed different? Is this a limitation as well? And to what extent?
Oh, sorry. That is, so first of all, just to make sure that we are, that just to make sure that maybe I was not clear enough here. So let me clarify this for a moment. So an assumption is that all parts of the, let's say, pristine image or original, if you like. I intended to talk here about originals. So if I have an original coming out of a camera, the assumption is that essentially in all parts the same thing has happened. Yeah. If this assumption is significantly violated, we run into trouble because we think, okay, it's supposed to be a manipulation because the statistical models deviate. And we're screwed. But if we think about something like like this digital image stabilization, it's really the best shot that we can take at it because the whole image is artificial when it comes out of a camera. So we cannot, like, we have to throw away a lot of model assumptions, particularly for these statistical methods. No, cannot assume anything about sensor cells or whatever anymore. Yeah, so that is what I meant. And if you think of image stabilization, then maybe this statement makes more sense, because like all of the image has to be stabilized. It doesn't make sense to stabilize half of the image. No? Yeah, so, right. But this is a critical assumption. Good, yeah?
Would it then break with the camera zoom, because you have talked about this radial distortion, the anti-radial, the distortion removement, basically. And I guess we apply radial undistortion, it then is, yeah, well, the region, as it is different on the outside.
Yeah.
The setup.
This is an excellent question. I think the short answer is we did not explicitly observe this. It makes sense when I think about it. Absolutely, yeah.
Probably depends on the method.
Yeah, and also what regions you actually consider to build your model. No. I mean, the way how we applied it, and essentially also Annalisa applied it, is that we used the whole image for training and then looked and then picked specific areas and said, okay, what is the distance of this area to the model of the whole image? So, and that was probably why we didn't notice something like this. Or we didn't notice because we were sloppy. That would also be an explanation. Yeah. No, it's a good point. It's really a good point. Yeah. Yeah, we will see. So that's really ongoing research. Good. Next time, I don't know, what did I put on the schedule? Will I talk about JPEG or some physics-based method? So next time we will talk about older methods again. And also next week, it would be great if we could start to make appointments for oral exams. If that's too early for you, it's also no problem. We can also do it later, but at least the week after that, Or 2 weeks after that, I'm somewhere out of town. So we should get started at least and see what we can assign then. Yeah. Okay, good. Good. Then thank you and see you next week.